Award-winning filmmaker Ken Burns will be in Albany tomorrow night for a special preview of his upcoming landmark film, The American Revolution, at 7 o'clock at the Palace Theater in Albany, New York. Ken Burns and co-director Sarah Botstein will present clips from the highly anticipated film and share stories from their 8-year journey to bring this dynamic and rich story to life. The American Revolution is a new 6-part, 12-hour documentary series that explores the country's founding struggle and its 8-year war for independence. It will premiere on Sunday, November 16th, and air for 6 consecutive nights through Friday, November 21st, from 8 to 10 on WMHT and PBS stations nationwide. The series was directed and produced by Ken Burns, Sarah Botstein, and David Schmidt, and written by longtime collaborator Jeffrey Ward. Before their visit tomorrow night, it is a great pleasure to welcome Ken Burns and Sarah Botstein to this morning's roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. What a delight to have you both here.
Thank you, Joe. Our pleasure.
Great to be here.
Wonderful to have you. Ken, let's begin. At what point did this start to you realize this seems like just knowing your work that you knew, I would think, deep within yourself that at some point this was a project you were going to work on.
Yeah, it scared me for an awful long time, and it remained just sort of just a thought. We don't really choose something till it drops down into our hearts or our guts or both, and we feel it. And we were finishing our Vietnam series in December of 2015, and I remember looking up at Sarah and saying, "We're doing the revolution next." And that, Barack Obama had 13 months to go in his presidency. The next month was the Iowa caucuses, out of which the large field of Republican candidates were going to winnow themselves down. And Donald Trump was not among those. So it's been a long, long journey of discovery for us, in which the main discipline is to sort of block out the noise of today, to block out the ways in which any historical event resonates with whatever's going on, because it's taken us not 8 years, it's taken us, we're well past 9.5 years since that critical moment to decide to do it. It's difficult. There are no photographs, there's no newsreels, but we had to overcome that. I think we have in really interesting ways. But the most important thing is that the story of our origin has been smothered in kind of gallant and bloodless myth. And it's really important. Maybe it's understandable that you're worried that the big ideas that are taking place in Philadelphia will be diminished. They are not. They're only increased and enlarged. And so it was our attempt to show the American Revolution, not just from the top down, but from the bottom up, all the players involved, Native American, women, French, British, Spanish, enslaved and free African Americans, the whole ball of wax, and to understand it as a civil war. Much more than our civil war, which was a sectional war, was a civil war. This was a civil war. And that's a big task. And to get the facts right, we've worked with more than 2 dozen scholars, both on camera and behind the camera, and sometimes both, and spent years filming the extraordinary people who reenact these struggles with extraordinary authenticity, and collecting the paintings and the drawings, creating maps, and being faithful to what the topography of the time looked like. And then the great genius is Jeff's writing, Peter Coyote's reading of that writing, and the dozens and dozens of people who read the first person voices off camera, from Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks to Sir Kenneth Branagh and Damian Lewis to Claire Danes and Paul Giamatti. I mean, it is a cast list that I don't even think The Longest Day, the great Hollywood film about D-Day, has as remarkable a cast list reading off camera as our film. So we're so excited to be in the Albany area, first at Saratoga and then in Albany itself. It's a pivotal place in the story of the revolution, one of the most important, if not the most important, moments taking place, and to come back to old stomping grounds for several films of ours and to share it is exciting. And then, of course, being able in November to share the whole thing with everybody across the country.
I am a question for both of you. I'm interested in both your perspectives on this, but as you say, of boxing out what's happening over that 9.5 year period, it seems Well, necessary, obviously, as you indicated, Ken, but also that it would be tough because there is going to be that nagging, the pulling on our the nudge on our shoulder of saying, okay, but this is the context, and this feels very real at this moment. So how do you deal with that balance?
Well, I'll take a stab at this first and then toss it over to Ken. I think every film I've made with Ken, and I think this speaks to our process, which is part of the reason we work at public television is because we take our time. And these films do not get made in 18 months or 24 months, and they get made in a big series like this over nearly a decade.
Let me pick up. She's absolutely right. The process permits us to sort of tune out a little bit of the temporal stuff. You'll see a clip in Tomorrow Night where there's a German, the wife of a German officer who's coming to join Burgoyne's army, assuming it's going to be the triumph of the British army. It doesn't work out that way, but she's coming across the ocean worried that Americans eat cats. That's what she's heard. Now, if our film came out last year, eating cats would be a big deal. It may not be a big deal this time, but there's lots and lots of amazing things. There's a failed invasion of Canada. There's a continent-wide pandemic. There's a total eclipse of the sun. There's lots of rhymes with the present moment. And what you have to be on a big project that lasts a decade, as Sarah's suggesting, is just be disciplined enough to sort of keep your head down, tell them this year eating cats is not going to be as funny as last year. The eclipse will play wherever it is. And right now, this whole invasion of Canada has a kind of eerie resonance. But we don't play, we're umpires calling balls and strikes. We're not saying, putting a neon sign and saying, isn't this so much like today? Because it's just a fool's errand.
And the context changes. We put our heads down and try to tell, as Ken was just saying, a thoughtful, fact-based, chronological history of the event that we're talking about and have it interpreted in the case like this with people who were alive at the time and left some kind of record of their views or their memories of the event, interwoven with scholars who are also generational. We have scholars like Gordon Wood and Bernard Bailyn and their students in the film, and young scholars younger than me who are interested in this for all kinds of reasons, some of them going back to 1976, the last time our country came together to wrestle with, where have we done well when it comes to our founding story and where have we not done so well, and how does that inform both our past, our present, and our future?
What goes, Ken, into those discussions of what history has done well and what history has not done as well in describing something as enormous as our American Revolution?
You want to get out of the way of making absolute definitive things. We're not Moses. We're not coming down from Mount Sinai with the tablets. We're not passing on the received judgments. We're just saying all of this stuff happened. And we trust our audience. That's another hallmark of PBS. We don't think everybody's an idiot. We want them to be ignorant. We presume that they're ignorant, but curious about this story. So it is not our right to ram a certain point of view, whether it's historical or political or social or any other way. We're just saying, here's sort of what happened, and we're going to tell you not just from the top down, but from the bottom up and include all the players. And so there's not that sense that we have an obligatory syllabus that is attached somehow invisibly to this story. It's like, this is a great story. I mean, I can throw it back to you, Joe. How were the patriots, both rich and poor, all men, who dumped tea in Boston Harbor dressed?
Yeah, I
You don't
don't
know.
know.
Okay,
Yeah.
so most school kids would tell you they're dressed as Native Americans. So I
Right.
ask,
Yeah.
why are they dressed as Native Americans? And everybody goes said, oh, to put the blame over on them. It's not, as the scholar Phil DeLoria says in our film, it's a way of distancing yourself from the mother country. We're Aboriginal now. It's so ironic, of course, because we're in the process of dispossessing those Aboriginal peoples of their land. But we're trying to make a point to the British that we're not of you anymore. We are something else. And this is a big moment in 17. It's not Lexington and Concord, which is the beginning, but it's one of those several opening shots in which you go, oh, wow. And so what you have is just a take. We don't have to, you don't have to say anything more than that. You just say crudely dressed as Native Americans. And then before you go, well, that's to put the blame on them, you hear a scholar say, uh-uh. It's a way to say we're no longer of you, the mother country. We've separated. And, that's a big deal. And it has a kind of resonance. And the school kids that we talk to, even the general audiences that know about the dressed as Indians and presume it's to just to put the blame off, are like woken up. So we don't have to point arrows at it and say, here's your lesson. There's a test on
Right.
Tuesday. Be sure to note this. It's just, you go, wow, I didn't know that. And I think the experience of people, as we've screened the film, clips from the film, and in some cases, episodes of the film around the country for the last 6 months, the main thing is like, wow, I had no idea. And that's also from some scholars, too. Scholars that we hired who gave us expertise about this particular area suddenly looked over and said, wow, I didn't know this character, or I didn't know this intricacy. Sarah.
No, but it's because I think we've talked a lot about this with the scholars who are in the film. We tell a very braided story. We don't tell a siloed thematic story. And they work oftentimes in their small space of some aspect of the history. So they get to come together with us, sit around the table, and learn from each other. What we want our audiences to do, to just piggyback on Ken, is to one, be curious. Curiosity is at the heart of the human experience. The more curious you are, the better your life is going to be. The more you're going to learn, the happier you will be, I promise. And we want our viewers to ask questions and want to learn more. And we want them to go, whoa, I feel one way. And then, oh my God, I feel some other way. Because that is, again, at the heart of who we are and what our history is.
Ken Burns and Sarah Botstein join us on the roundtable this morning. They will be in Albany tomorrow to talk about the PBS landmark film, The American Revolution, which will be airing on PBS in November. I recently did an event with Rick Atkinson, who I know worked with you, and one of the things that he said that I thought was interesting is, and you just said this, Ken, but there are certainly different historic versions, and historians have very strong thoughts on what happened. And so how do you as filmmakers navigate those sometimes small, sometimes larger disagreements?
So that's a really wonderful question, Joe. And I think Sarah began to answer that in a way that that ours are braided. And so we're not favoring one version of history over another. What's so nice is that the scholars sort of hand off to each other, and they may not completely disagree, but we're not setting up oppositional dynamics in our film. We're just saying, at this particular point, as we yield from, say, the smallpox epidemic and anxieties and decisions about inoculation within the Continental Army, and what does George Washington going to do? And one scholar says his greatest military decision is to inoculate the troops. That's there. It doesn't need to be commented on. Nobody has to do a subliminal shot to, Dr. Fauci. You just say, this is what's going on. Another point, there's a total eclipse. You've got that, as I said, the invasion of Canada. So these things kind of roll out, and what you find, and the key word that what Sarah said, in addition to braided, is facts, right? People are entitled, as Daniel Patrick Moynihan said, to their own set of opinions, but they're not entitled to their own set of facts. And the problem with today, outside of public media, is that we are, a country that is willing to sort of invent stuff whole cloth and pretend, and because of the huge proliferation in the internet, get away with just these bold-faced lies. We cannot do that. And so this is all based on facts. And we are so anxious. We locked the film in January. We've unlocked it, Joe, hundreds of times to put in a word like perhaps 16, where we had said 16 before. Because we now had heard from yet a seventh scholar that it may not have been that many, right? And we've got footnotes in our script, 16 to 18, whatever it is, months, dead, canon, it doesn't matter. You know what I'm saying. And so we just want to massage this to the point where the story is so accurate that it cannot be assailed and is so unusual and surprising that people will go, "I had no idea." I had a 3-hour conversation with Joe Rogan, and most of the time he's going, "Wow, I had no idea." And that was as we got into the nitty-gritty of the revolution. That's exciting that we can speak to everybody across. There's no divisions. Everybody has is a human being. Everybody has a human experience, and that human experience is contradictory and it's confusing and sometimes a thing, as Wynton Marsalis said in our jazz film, and the opposite of a thing are true at the same time. And if you can build a narrative, as we've tried to do in all our films, not just this one, that is able to hold those contradictions, then it's not a question of choosing between one philosophy or another. It's just saying, even at that time, things are contested. Some people saw things differently, and you can acknowledge that, and it empowers us as filmmakers first, and we hope viewers later.
Sarah, this is a massive project by any measure. It's a huge undertaking, certainly by the amount of hours, but also in the years that it has taken to put together. Give us a sense in the making of it, of first of all, what is it like to have three directors on a project?
Well, first of all, you asked the right person. You asked the general of this operation, Sarah, to answer that question, which is exactly right.
I mean, I say this all the time. One of the reasons I love my job is because we work in such a collaborative art form. Sort of, it's almost like we're one person. We all need each other to row the boat. So these films are not made alone, and they're made by an incredibly talented team. And figuring out over the course of nearly a decade, okay, we're going to do some research, we're going to do some X, Y, or Z, but we're very flexible and very fungible. So we're always shooting, we're always researching, we're always interviewing. We edit for a distinct period of time because otherwise we would all lose our minds. But as Ken was just saying, there's flexibility at the end of that as we go through fact checking and post production and do sound. And, at our smallest, we're 4 or 5 people, and at our biggest, we're 45 or 50. And it's an incredible team. Some of us have worked, I mean, Jeff Ward has worked with Ken for 40 years. I've worked for Ken for almost 30. We know each other very, very well. We are incredibly dedicated, and we all need each other. And we're constantly listening to each other. And, in some ways, we're extremely organized. We're never late. We're extremely punctual. We're never over budget. We stay in our lanes. We meet our marks. We're very disciplined that way. And we're also fastidious. So for a couple of years while we're bringing in archives, you almost don't hear a peep in our office as everyone is logging information and metadata related to a painting or a map or a pamphlet or a piece of music. We're just gathering, gathering, gathering. And then we sift through all of that with our editors and spend a lot of time both visually and orally figuring out how to tell the story. But it's a mammoth, huge operation at its apex, and tiny and very hand-sewn at its smallest.
Ken, I would be remiss if I didn't, in our last minute or two together, ask you of, as you have mentioned public media a few times, of how you feel at this moment. We're about to go into fund drive mode again. It's been a rough go. It's been a rough year, and I'm interested in your thoughts oh God, if you have any optimism, I'll go for that too.
I do. We're going to survive. What's so short-sighted and sad about this is that the stations that are going to be affected the most, NPR and PBS, are the rural stations, the places that will now be news deserts, that there is the place where it's the only signal that people get, that it's where they get not just our superb prime time and children's programming, but classroom of the air and continuing education and emergency alerts and weather things. And so all of that is now going to just disappear out of a lot of Americans' lives. And that's the tragedy of it. What's not a tragedy is the fact that the people who are listening to us, only a very small percentage actually become members. And this is the time, if you've ever held off and say, well, you know, this is the time to help make up the deficit. Yesterday, PBS cut a huge number of its staff at the national level, who is the least dependent on the money from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. We, Sarah and I, on our upcoming project, have just lost money already committed by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. We just lost $4 million. We just added to our, and that's not counting the stuff we are talking to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting about, another $10 million, which we were pretty much assured that we would get over the coming year. So we're talking about a $14 million hit that just the two of us have to now go and figure out how to make up. And this is a story that's being replicated all across out of some narrow interpretation of politics. This is the network, PBS, that had William F. Buckley for 32 years on firing line, the most renowned conservative. It's, if you look at the primetime schedule, you know, sure, there's complicated, you know, public affairs stuff. But if you're so worried of somebody holding an opposite of opinion, and in order to be able to sleep at night, you have to kill them, this is not what we signed up for. So I think what we need is for, now is the time for all good people to come to the aid of their country. And we were founded with the idea of the pursuit of happiness. That is not the acquisition of objects in a marketplace of things. It is lifelong learning in a marketplace of ideas. And there is no better place, the Declaration of Independence applied to the communications world, than public broadcasting, either PBS or NPR. And now is the time to support it. If you haven't done it before, if you've already done it, then dig a little bit deeper and help this system weather the rough seas that we're about to enter into.
Yeah, I think a fair, balanced, free press is also a foundational piece of our republic, and our founders felt that way.
Ken Burns and Sarah Botstein are our guests this morning. They're going to be in Albany tomorrow night at the Palace Theater to preview The American Revolution, which is an amazing event that will premiere on Sunday, November 16th, and air for six consecutive nights through Friday, November 21st at 8 to 10 p.m. on WMHT and PBS stations nationwide. Ken Burns, Sarah Botstein, what a great pleasure to have you both here. We look forward to seeing you in Albany tomorrow night, and it's great to have you here. Thank you so much for your time and your beautiful words.
Thank
We're
you.
We're really excited.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Again, you can find out more information by going to palacealbany.com. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.